Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, when President Kennedy was confronted by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, he formed an executive committee to assist him in deciding on a course of action. 20 years later, four members of that committee met to reflect on the lessons learned. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Gentlemen, we have a chance to spend a little time looking back on the Cuban Missile Crisis as a whole, and trying to get you to free associate about lessons you want to draw from it. If you decide you haven't got any lessons, I'll ask some more questions. But a breather from my questions. I'll give you a chance to generalize a bit, retrospecting the thing. Let's start out with you, Mr. Secretary.
To me, the overriding lesson to be drawn from the Cuban Missile Crisis is that governments, and particularly the governments of the two nuclear superpowers, must do their best to try to avoid such crises because they're so utterly dangerous. I've never met a demigod or a Superman. I've seen a lot of ordinary human beings carry major responsibilities, grappling with the circumstances in which they find themselves, but human beings with feet of clay. And now that such terrible destruction is operationally possible, we must find ways to back off and not let such crises appear. One small illustration of that. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy and his senior advisors were pretty cool and pretty calm throughout the entire exercise. But we sustained a crisis at a very high level of intensity for some 13 days. How long can human beings sustain a crisis at that level before sleeplessness, weariness, fear of the unknown, suspicion, accident begin to play a role? So I hope that both Washington and Moscow learned that we must back away from such crises and not let them develop. I think it's true that after the Cuban Missile Crisis, both Washington and Moscow were somewhat more prudent than they were before the crisis occurred. But is this a lesson that is automatically transmitted from one generation to the next of leaders who appear on the scene in our major countries? I wish I could be sure of that. But I hope that future leaders in both countries will reflect upon these things and take care.
Mac Bundy has said on a couple of occasions publicly that the crisis might have been avoided, this particular crisis might have been avoided. You haven't particularized on that. Well, follow up this comment a little. What could have been done, Mac?
I think the point I'm making when I say that, and I'll explain in a moment, is very close to the main line of the argument that Secretary has just made, which I strongly agree with, that the primary point about the missile crisis is how dangerous that kind of confrontation between the superpowers is in the period of the age of thermonuclear weapons, which we're in and are not going to get out of for a long time, if ever. When I say that there were miscalculations that could have been avoided, I think it's fairly obvious that there was a Soviet miscalculation. Khrushchev clearly did not enter into this enterprise with the object of being required to withdraw the missiles under American pressure, so that it didn't come out the way he intended it. And he plainly failed to understand how unacceptable the effort to place those missiles in Cuba would be from the point of view of the United States government and the American people. So he made a gross miscalculation. But we also made a miscalculation because we did not expect him to do this. We surely thought he would not, because we knew what it would mean to us. And so by the time we were aware that this was a possibility on which our position should be made plain, which is more or less September, and issued the grave warnings that we've discussed earlier, the president stating publicly that if it were to be that way, different from what he then expected, if it were to be otherwise, the gravest issues would arise. Mm-hmm. But to say that in September, when the military plans are afoot and the ships are on the way and the digging has probably just begun, is very different from to say it, let us say, 6 months earlier, before a Soviet decision has been taken, because then the clear exposition of an American position would be a part of the calculation that Khrushchev would have to make. So that I draw the lesson, and I think on this most of us who went through it would agree, that clarity about one's interests, clarity about the things which would raise grave issues is very important. There is another school of thought, which is that you should leave the adversary in great doubt. And a certain amount of uncertainty is built into the problems of the nuclear age and is an argument for the kind of care and restraint that the Secretary was talking about. But I don't think, looking back on it, since it was so obvious to us that an action of this kind would have these consequences, that we did as good a job as we should have of making it plain early enough.
I dragged you into that comment. You're entitled.
Well, I think
that's of your own, if you wish.
There are. There's another very important point, which not everybody agrees with. I think probably most of us here do. I know the Secretary and I have talked about it, written about it, and I think we agree about it. That when you look at what led to the successful resolution of the crisis, from our point of view, you can argue, and many have argued, that it was the consequence of what was then, in fact, numerically, an overwhelming superiority in strategic nuclear weapons. That's particularly a favorite view among people who think that it makes an enormous difference in this time, whether you have more or less or have equality or parity. But I don't believe it. I believe, and I think we believed in the cabinet room as we talked about it, and I'm quite confident that the president believed, and his belief is decisive here, that nobody was going to make the hideous choice of using nuclear weapons if he could possibly avoid it, that although indeed we had a certain superiority, it was not a usable superiority in the sense that we would ever want to go first. Because if even one Soviet weapon landed on an American target, we would all be losers. I think, and I believe myself, that the evidence is persuasive, that what really made it necessary for Khrushchev to decide that he would remove the provocation was the fact that he had no choice, no good choice, in terms of resistance to any military action we might take in the Caribbean, because the Caribbean was an area of naval supremacy and of great superiority in every other respect of conventional forces for the United States. And that decisive point was as plain to him as it was to us. Now, you can argue, and it's important to take into account, you can argue that what made Berlin stable was in part the nuclear balance, and I would agree with that. So that in that sense, there is a relation between nuclear strength and the question of possible Soviet adventures elsewhere. But as to the situation in Cuba, it was the prospect of a conventional pressure on that island in one form or another, about which he could do nothing, that made it urgent for him to decide. Now, one must add, and we've talked about that, I'm going on too long, that if we had left it at that, mere military pressure, if we had tried to drive him into a corner without taking account of his necessities, we don't know what might have happened. And I'm sure, looking back on it, that those of us who were there when the president made his decision that it was right to give assurances on the question of the Turkish missiles, and assurances that if the missiles went out, there would not be an invasion of Cuba, that that was the right way to give Khrushchev reasonable working room to accept our basic demand.
If I hear you right, there are two separate strands. One is, one might be put this way, Mr. Khrushchev in his memoirs says, in effect, well, no matter what else happens, how much superiority they, what they, no matter what they could have done to us, we could always have taken out New York.
I don't know why you picked New York.
Yes, there is some, we shouldn't push that one too far. But one thing you're saying is the risk that that might happen as a result of a series of steps was something to be avoided if humanly possible.
Oh, more than
from
that.
Your point
it
of view.
Was a requirement, and
right.
Nobody understands this better than the secretary, who can remind us how that was at the time. It's you just aren't interested in winning a nuclear war. What you're interested in is not having one.
This is of extraordinary importance in a period in the 1980s when a lot of people are foolishly talking about limited nuclear wars and counterforce strikes and protracted nuclear war that we might come out ahead on, that sort of thing. Just a lot of nonsense going around. If all of the nuclear weapons that now lie around in the hands of frail human beings were to be fired in some agonized half hour someday, there'd be a serious question as to whether this planet could any longer sustain the human race. Now, that's the thing that we've got to respect and back away from. But on the other hand, I think we can draw a measure of genuine encouragement from this Cuban Missile Crisis. Here, the two nuclear superpowers were at each other's jugular veins. And we came through it without that catastrophe. I think we ought to take account of the fact that the doomsday talk may also be unrelated to reality. We put behind us 37 years since a nuclear weapon has been fired in anger, despite some very grave crises along the way. I personally do not believe that the world is filled with crazies on this subject, and that those who are carrying responsibilities are going to opt for mutual suicide. So I'm relatively hopeful. I commented some time ago that I thought we were further away from a full nuclear war today than we've been in 30 years. And I believe that. But I think we can draw some elements of encouragement out of the successful navigation by both sides of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
One can underline that by looking at the two individuals. Those of us who worked for President Kennedy were very well aware of his own heavy sense of responsibility and of his determination to watch over the points of danger, as the Secretary said in an earlier conversation, like a desk officer, not simply as a chairman of the board. And I don't think most of us would pick Khrushchev as the most prudent and careful and temperamentally stable world leader that we've ever heard of or encountered. And his decision to put the missiles in will not rank as his most prudent choice. But even though his letter of the Friday was rambling and went all over the place, it did bespeak the deep concerns of a man who did not want us to tie the ropes that could then not be untied and march toward a catastrophe.
Remember, it was Khrushchev who said that in the event of a nuclear war, the living would envy the dead.
Right, right.
And he was very careful. The plane that went off course, the American plane that went off course that you all alluded to yesterday, in his memoirs, he says the issue came up to him, and he countermanded the standard orders.
Both leaders upset their military by refusing to play by military books in that week. And that also, excuse me, is a lesson for nowadays.
Fortunately, the pilot of that plane that strayed down over Siberia got on the open radio and called back to his base and said, "Hey, I think I'm lost." And he chatted in open radio, and the Russians undoubtedly picked that up and decided that he really was lost and didn't shoot him down.
A very scary affair.
I'd like to turn to another lesson, and one that I think both Ed Martin and Don Wilson can help us with. It's natural that in looking back at this as a confrontation, which it was, between the two superpowers, we may let slide the point that another quite critical element in our success here was that, on the whole, our case was persuasive to 3rd, 4th, 5th, 50th, and 60th parties. And it's a very interesting question what combination of determination and restraint made that effective in different parts of the world. And I think it would help us if we looked at it from that perspective for a while, because it wasn't just Kennedy versus Khrushchev, and neither of them thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Ed, you want to take that first?
Well, I'd like to take a couple others if I could first.
Sure. Well, I'll make you come back to it.
I'll come back. I'll think about this one while I'm talking about the others.
A diplomat.
Well, it seems to me that all you've said is correct, and both President Kennedy and Mr. Khrushchev behaved with reasonable responsibility once the crisis had surfaced. But I do think that one has to conclude that, and there's other evidence of a certain amount, that human beings are not always rational people. And in this case, the Soviets made a grave miscalculation with respect to U.S. response. And we have to try to arrange the world in such a way that those miscalculations, whether from lack of intelligence, whether from excess of emotion, or for other reasons, don't have too grave consequences. And this, I think, points to the ultimate danger of all these nuclear weapons lying around. And in every profession, not just in the high levels of government, people make obvious mistakes which are obviously mistakes to others. And so that I think this is a major consideration when we talk about armament reduction. Secondly, this was a mistake, a totally unexpected incident. We had the good fortune to have in the United States a president who had the qualities of courage, judgment, sensitivity to the well-being of mankind to conduct a wise response. Our electoral process increasingly has been devoted to candidates promising this, that, and the other in great detail. At a time when, unless they have been a president and are running for re-election, they're relatively uninformed about what the real problems are and what are the obstacles to this or that solution. And it seems to me that we ought to be concerned about how we can get at the very top an electoral process which would put more emphasis on the personal qualities of the man and how he will conduct himself when in office in dealing with what will, for the most part, be either new problems, the most serious will be, or old problems about which he will have a lot of new information and have to make new judgments that he didn't have when he was campaigning. I think this is a problem that both at the presidential and the legislative level represents a deterioration of the American political process of cause for deep concern. Fortunately, we were lucky in this case, and President Kennedy had the qualities that were required by a challenge which nobody could have anticipated he would have to meet. A third minor point is that it seems to me that, and we've emphasized this in preceding discussion, it is doubtful if we would have made as wise a decision if we hadn't had nearly a week to contemplate what should be done. In other words, freedom of the press can be carried too far, and there is a need to have an understanding between those at the top level of government and the press about when publicity is in the public interest and when it isn't. Now, I have no ideas how this would work out, probably more informally than formally, but we were very lucky, and most people think we could not have done it again in the present climate. But it was essential, in my judgment, to a wise decision. Now, on the point that you have raised, if we, of course, could have probably achieved the same result acting alone, without consulting or persuading other groups that this was the wise thing to do. We were able to do that, I think, because the president and his colleagues thought it mattered what the rest of the world thought about what we did, and that it may have mattered to the Soviets. After all, they are interested in world public opinion, in spreading their idea of what is the right way to govern a society. I have the feeling that while one can't put your finger on it, the complete solidarity of the NATO countries, and even more important because they had not been solid and were notable for criticizing the U.S., it was one of their parlor games. They were solid behind us.
The OAS.
The OAS group, the Latin American OAS group. And this, I think, reflected a willingness on the part of President Kennedy, who had been notable in his interest in Latin America. No president before or since has come close to his degree of interest and the time he spent on it. And Secretary Rusk had gone out of their way to establish confidence that they had not just the U.S. interest, but a broader interest in them and what happened to them, so that when we needed their support, they felt that we were in things together, had been working together, and this was something where their support for us was the right thing to do. This is partly public policy, but it's almost even more how you deal with people on a person-to-person basis. And as I've written in the past and said here, I think the patience that Secretary Rusk had shown in discussing this whole situation with the Latin Americans, the ambassadors, the foreign ministers, on a number of occasions in the month or so before the crisis, was a major factor in establishing this support, which many people thought we couldn't get.
Let me respond. I can recall a few crises where, as it turned out, ultimately the support from all parts of the world was as unanimous as it was in this one, and I think that was remarkable. And I don't think we anticipated it as we worked in that week before the speech was given. In retrospect, I would say that one of the main reasons that came about was first because of the suddenness and this enormous seriousness of the Soviet action. And secondly, and I pick up a bit from what Ed Martin just said, U.S. response. The U.S. response was measured. It was careful. It did indeed take into consultation our NATO allies and the OAS countries. And indeed, as the Secretary mentioned in a previous moment here, ambassadors from the non-aligned countries were brought in and briefed at an early point. We tried to bring everyone into our thinking and into our reasoning. And we also didn't, we took a line which I think was probably understood fairly soon thereafter that was a moderate line, the quarantine line, rather than a more harsh military line. And except for what I would regard in retrospect as a blip of public opinion in England and maybe a couple of other continental countries, which for a momentary period, they questioned whether the missiles really were there and whether they really were offensive missiles, a question that was answered promptly by the disclosure of the pictures. It was a remarkably unanimous reaction that took place throughout the entire world and was indeed, I think, very helpful to our cause.
One should underline the importance of those pictures, of the evidence and its undeniable character, because if we had been acting even on the most reliable agent reports or on the most careful analytic reconstruction of what must be true, our problem of persuasion in the court of public opinion would have been a lot more serious. And when Adlai Stevenson made his famous speech, prefaced by his remark that he would wait for the Soviet answer until hell froze over. When he made that speech, the fact that he had blown up reproductions of these pictures and could point to them drove home a fact which the Soviets had spent two or three days dancing away from in the court of public opinion and made a great difference. Now, you can't count on that kind of startling and persuasive and to your adversaries surprising evidence in these matters. And like the secrecy of the first week, that element should not be counted on in future encounters. If I may shift to just a slightly different point, but a related one, this subject got forced into that form of intense public confrontation because of the secrecy and deception of the Soviet action. But there's a deeper problem, which we began to repair, in a sense, during the second week of the crisis, a problem of communication. And it's important to notice that just as an important detail, the Soviet ambassador was informed of the contents of the speech before it was delivered. The lines were kept open through the week. It was to the advantage of both countries that the ambassador, the same ambassador that the Soviet government has now, was a highly trained professional and a man who had learned to communicate effectively, certainly with our government, and we all believe, I think, with his own government. It was also important to use the channel, which had been developed since 1961, of direct communication between the president and Khrushchev. And it was very important that we were able to formulate our message on the crucial second Saturday in a way that could be persuasively delivered by a man, the Attorney General, whose seriousness and whose closeness to the president no one could question. So the process of communication between these two deeply adversarial governments is something which we let slip at our peril and which we maintain not because they are charming or because our interests are identical, but because they are not.
I think it's worth pointing out to those who may have overlooked it that the Cuban Missile Crisis was responsible for the establishment of a hotline between the White House and the Kremlin in order to facilitate the communication at moments of crisis. And I think that was a step in the right direction. I further believe that there's considerable point in Americans and the American government and the Russian government talking things over at considerable length, not necessarily with respect to a particular issue or to arrive at a particular answer, but to exchange views on a wide range of things. For example, the human race as a whole is faced with a number of problems that are different in kind than we've ever faced before. Energy and the environment and the population explosion, the food problems and things like that. And there, we are united in a sense because we're all members of the human race. Now, if we can find ways to work together on those common problems, as we did work together for the elimination of smallpox, then it may be that that growing cooperation on other questions can begin to lay a calming hand on these turbulent political forces that lead to crisis. At least we ought to try.
And let me offer one other underlining to that point, which is beautifully exemplified in this crisis, but has a wider and deeper meaning. It's of very great importance to us to have, not only in moments of crisis, but in moments in all the kinds of complex dealings that we have necessarily with the Soviet Union, to have the advice and counsel of men and women who have given time and often their lives to the study and understanding of that different society. We've all united, I think, in our discussions here in noting the singular contribution of Llewellyn Thompson in the deepest moments of the crisis. His experience, his insight about the Soviet Union were not surpassed by anyone in that generation, and his capacity as a human being to communicate those in a way that inspired confidence and trust in the leaders of his own government were extraordinary. And that is simply a remarkable individual illustration of a general need that is as urgent now as ever, and perhaps a little less noticed. We may not be giving the kind of close attention to the health and strength of our studies of the Soviet Union and of other countries of very great importance and difficulty in understanding, like China. And I think it's useful to be reminded of that in a case where its value is so obvious.
Well, now, just to pick that up for a moment, Bolin and Thompson were the products of the Russian service that got started in the middle 20s within the Foreign Service. It was a deliberate effort to create a body of career experts. There was a comparable effort made about the same time to create a comparable group of China experts. These were dispersed in the early 50s. I don't know whether we are now making in the Foreign Service efforts to take care of the to create people who can serve the Thompson function 30 years from now with respect to either of these great mysterious powers.
Well, I think the individuals exist. The Secretary perhaps is more familiar with it than I am. But whether there is the kind of respect for deep inquiry, long association, and the willingness on a career basis to allow talent and experience in combination to ripen.
Yeah.
And whether in the wider society, the universities, where so many of us have spent so much of our lives, there is the kind of intense concern that one can remember in the first decades after the Second War, I think is an open question.
There's one aspect to that that is of some real interest to me. Vice President Lyndon Johnson was very actively involved in these discussions, the Cuban Missile Crisis. He had a number of long private talks with President Kennedy, just the two of them. He attended most of our meetings, and I had good many talks with him myself. Lyndon Johnson had an almost instinctive ability to put himself in the other fellow's shoes when a problem came up, to try to at least understand what it was that the other fellow was trying to do and how it looked from his vantage point. I think you'd probably learn that in dealing with senators of the United States Senate. But I think we must always bear that in mind. I think any good lawyer knows that if you really want to understand your own case, you must make a real effort to understand the other fellow's case. And we make a great mistake, I think, if we do not make a special effort to try to see what it is that is moving the other side in a crisis. And Llewellyn Thompson was superb in assisting us from that point of view.
One other point that I think bears mentioning is that on the day the crisis started to resolve itself, or did indeed begin to resolve itself on Sunday, President Kennedy almost immediately told the group that we should not crow, we should not say we're winners, we should not exult, and we did not do that. I think that was a very wise injunction that he issued at that time to this group, not only because it gave Mr. Khrushchev more room to settle his very difficult problems back in Moscow, but I think also in terms of world opinion, it was a very smart course to take.
It's an interesting point to make, and I think you're dead right about it. I don't think he would have anticipated what has happened in some quarters in the years since. The criticism from generally right-wing circles of our failure to get as much as we should have. And my own view of teaching value of this new view is that when people in retrospect tell their government that it should have gotten more, it would be very helpful if we could transport them back into the atmosphere of the time in which the decisions were being made, because the kinds of things that they think we should have done, not sure everybody will agree with me on this, the kinds of things they think we should have done in terms of increasing pressure on Cuba, in terms of trying to clean up what is obviously a continuing nuisance in the Caribbean from our point of view, are, I would have to say, absolutely trivial when measured against the risks that were set loose in the world by this crisis. And I think we were extraordinarily fortunate to have a president who himself concluded, and without, I think, dissent among his senior advisors, that this crisis was not the time for resolving all the problems of the Caribbean. It was a time for getting rid of a threat to the survival of the nations primarily concerned.
Let me pick you up at that point on one thing that I think it's important to get out and be clear about and get you gentlemen to comment on. This crisis is a seminal event in the sense that you draw these lessons, and other people who were there at slightly different levels draw sharply different lessons.
That's fair.
Which have begun to come out now in all kinds of policy advice that is really almost the opposite of the advice implicit in what you're saying. Let me illustrate this. Shortly after this crisis, just by accident, I happened to wander into a closed briefing by the vice chief of air staff for plants.
Who let you in?
Well, I was at RAND on some unrelated matter, and it was the feature of the day, so I wandered in.
Good question.
He was giving his lessons of the crisis. This was 4 months after. And his logic was very clear. It ran as follows. The Soviets are rational people. They have always acted rationally with respect to the major military problems facing them. the Americans had absolute conventional superiority, tactical superiority in the area, as you have said, Mac, and overwhelming strategic superiority. So that had there been Had it come to nuclear exchange, they would have been destroyed. The United States wouldn't. Therefore, once the president had publicly committed himself, irretrievably in his own terms, there was no risk except for the flap at the White House. And the problem next time is to wall those people off. See? Now,
fellow flapper.
Now, 20 years later, you know, that translates into, well, that's at the base, that logic is at the base of a lot of things. We should have got more. Nuclear superiority is of the essence and so forth. And this whole set of lessons has been rumbling and developing under the surface now for a long time. And I want to get you to come to grips with it.
Well, the general had a free ride on that one because he was making that analysis 4 months after the crisis. And that's easy. But anyone who makes the judgment that if you just say boo, the other side is going to roll over and play dead is making an irrational and possibly irreparable mistake. It's not the way it happens in the real world, and this kind of rationale might be an argument for making some increases in the defense budget, but it's not valid reasoning from the point of view of handling a crisis where other nations and other human beings are directly involved who have stakes that may be vital to their own interests. So I don't accept that kind of analysis.
I do think it shows you a problem that's very deep and one where one should, in line with the Secretary's advice a few minutes ago, take account of how it looks to a man who's saying that. He is a military man. He is thinking about what happens if it comes to a battle. He's not really asking himself whether a politician wants that battle. He's going to win the thermonuclear war. Then he's going to lose maybe not only New York, but Cambridge, you know? He wins, but the country loses. And if you ask that same man to back up, he'll see that point. I found very sensible perceptions of the difference between deterrence and war among senior commanders of the Strategic Air Command. Same thing about superiority in Cuba. Sure, we can win a war in Cuba. Will we win in the long run in terms of our relations to the hemisphere or even to Cuba itself if we precipitate a ground war with Cuba on the pretext that it is required by something the Soviet Union has done? Is that a good long-term Western Hemisphere policy? He's not asking that question. So that if you take any one professional line in, you can get into terrible trouble.
Mm-hmm.
If in that crisis, the question of how British public opinion might react on the second day had been allowed to decide matters, we would have done nothing. I think the country, I won't hold a brief for any particular flap artist in the White House, but I think the country was well served by the fact that we had time to think the matter over, which is another way of saying flap.
Well, no, and a third way of saying it is the point you just went over. Political objectives, in the highest sense of the term, are simply incommensurately different.
They are different, and it reappears now because you get people talking as if in a world in which both sides have something like 10,000 strategic weapons, 500 weapons of this kind are somehow decisive.
Ridiculous.
It really doesn't make any sense. We've known it didn't make any sense for 30 years, political men have.
Mm-hmm.
The first description of the thermonuclear balance of terror is in an extraordinary speech that Winston Churchill gives to the House of Commons in the middle 1950s, at a time when there weren't large-scale deliverable systems on the Soviet side and very few on ours. But he saw it coming, and he understood that it wouldn't make any difference if you had twice as much as the other man, if he had enough, so that neither of you could ever possibly gain in terms of the future of your own society by starting that kind of war. Now, I don't want to say that the general, whom you have not identified and who is undoubtedly a splendid human being, misunderstands that, but he isn't trained to bear it in mind at every stage of the decision-making process in relation to the Soviet Union. And his assumption that the Soviets would be always rational is an assumption we don't want any of us to make about anybody else in a moment of very high strain.
I think I know something about the decisions made by the United States to use its armed forces over the last half century. And I can't think of a single instance in which that decision was made on the initiative of our military. They were not the ones coming in, banging the table, saying, turn us loose and we'll go get those fellows. The decisions were made by the constitutional authorities of the country. Now, the general was not at a moment of decision when he was talking. In between times, they can come up with some pretty fancy talk about this and that and the other. But that's not the way it works at the around the table when the decision has to be made. So I'm not particularly concerned about the general's view on that.
Give us some more trouble.
Would it have made any difference to you, do you think, in your discussions during that week, had the strategic relationship been other than it was? Had relatively speaking, the United States been in a position of, quote, inferiority, rather than, quote, superiority?
Well, McGeorge Bund has already, in effect, made the point that there comes a moment where discussion of superiority and inferiority is almost irrelevant, given the total capacity for destruction that already exists. We did not count missiles on each side during the Cuban Missile Crisis, although the Russians apparently thought later that we had. The simple fact is that nuclear power does not translate into usable political influence. And that is true among 160 nations around the world, and it really is true between the two nuclear superpowers, because each side understands that they're talking about mutual suicide. No, I think we would have felt that we had to get those missiles out of Cuba. And the strategic computation was not one of those slide rule things in which we put all the numbers in a basket and decide, aha, we have a superiority here. Because at this level of destruction, discussions of superiority tend to be irrelevant.
It's really a hard problem to translate when you think about both sides, because I think we do feel, I do anyway, in retrospect, that one of the important motives on the Soviet side, hard to balance which is more and which is less important, was in fact to redress what they regarded as a very grave strategic imbalance, mm-hmm. and one that was getting worse because mm-hmm. of the building program which we had accelerated, which the Eisenhower administration had begun. So no doubt that was part of the motivation. And the incentive to do that for the Soviet Union is lower now, probably, although it's hard to say precisely. The reaction to such a secret move now, one hopes it could not be achieved secretly, would be different for the very fact that 100 more weapons are less meaningful now than they were then.
And this would be perceived around the world.
One would suppose so. I mean, but, you know, we still have terrible troubles understanding that if somebody has 10,000 weapons, his deployment of 500 more doesn't matter very much.
Well, all right.
I was going to say, listen to congressional testimony, you wouldn't think that 100 made no difference.
I will take that
I didn't say it made no difference in terms of congressional testimony or even public perceptions. But when you get that kind of a grave misunderstanding, one which I think myself we now have in this argument over the intermediate missiles in Europe, the task of political leadership is to try to lower the level of misunderstanding, not merely respond to it.
Now, a high Russian official commented to Mr. John J. McCloy after this Cuban Missile Crisis was over, "Well, Mr. McCloy, you got away with it this time, but you'll never get away with it again." I have no doubt myself that after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviet Union made a decision to build up their missile forces, and if you take into account lead time and production and all the rest of it, some of the missiles we've been seeing on stream in the last few years undoubtedly came out of decisions made shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis. I personally think that is a misperception on the part of the Soviets, and I hope that that does not mean that they somehow will count numbers, and when they think that they have a few ahead, that they will embark upon some adventure that they think they can get away with, because that's the way in which fatal misjudgments can be made.
It's an interesting comment. I don't have any reason to doubt it, but we also have tended to brag about our patience with the Russians in settling the crisis, led to the Test Ban Treaty and other progress in the disarmament area.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you just one last question. I've always thought it was your finest hour. If there was flap in the White House, I'm glad. I want to make my own position clear on that one. But is it your impression that the president had as much control to play the role of desk officer as he wanted and needed?
Well, you never... One of the things the desk officer finds out, I think, is that you never have as much control as you'd like to have. You have a chance to talk with the people who are closer to the military management. You'll certainly find that there were tensions in that process. And you will find that the president himself had a sense from time to time in those 2 weeks that not everybody was hearing him as clearly as he hoped they would. There are frictions in any process. This was not, thank God, a war, but some of the fog of war surrounded the movements of forces and the interpretation of messages and all the rest.
Now, does this add to his sensitivity about Khrushchev?
I think so. I think the point we were making a minute ago, that each of them was careful not to allow standing military response procedures to govern the way in which, in fact, one responded to an invasion of his territory by an airplane off course, and the other to the loss of a plane to a missile attack in surface-to-missile, surface-to-air missile attack in Cuba, shows that both of them were thinking about how it would be read in the other country. Now, that's an inexact art.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think we have to bear that in mind. And there were, indeed, real questions as to whether, by the standing procedures of all of the services, the signals that went out were, in every case, the ones the president intended. But I don't happen to have detailed knowledge, because the president had an assistant desk officer for military matters named Robert McNamara.
But we'll get to him later. Mr. Rusk, have you got a final thought you want to give us on these matters?
You spoke of this as our finest hour. I've never looked upon it in those terms. The experience was actually somewhat humbling, I think. We managed to pass through this valley of death successfully, but I think we came out of it realizing that we must not make that trip too often, and that we can be thankful that the matter was resolved without a major conflagration, and that we better be pretty careful about how we deal with these matters and try to avoid the approach to the cliff over which we might all plunge.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
What you have heard are the recollections of four of those who were members of XCOM, the Committee of 15 who were gathered to advise the president as he confronted the Cuban Missile Crisis. The president had recollections of his own, which he shared with correspondents from the three major networks a few weeks after the crisis itself.
How does a president go about making a decision, like Cuba, for example?
The most recent one was hammered out, really, our policy and decision over a period of 5 or 6 days. During that period, the 15 people, more or less, who were directly consulted, frequently changed their view because whatever action we took had so many disadvantages to it. And each action that we took raised the prospect that it might escalate with the Soviet Union into a nuclear war. Finally, however, I think a general consensus developed and certainly seemed after all alternatives were examined that the course of action that we finally adopted was the right one. Now, when I talked to members of the Congress, several of them suggested a different alternative when we confronted them on that Monday with the evidence. My feeling is that if they had gone through the five-day period we had gone through at looking at the various alternatives, the advantages and disadvantages of action, they probably would have come out the same way that we did. I think we took the right one. If we had had to act on the Wednesday in the first 24 hours, I don't think probably we would have chosen as prudently as we finally did, a quarantine against the use of offensive weapons. In addition, that had much more power than we first thought it did. Because I think the Soviet Union was very reluctant to have us stop ships which carried with them a good deal of their highly secret and sensitive material. Another, one of the reasons I think that the Soviet Union withdrew the IL-28s was because we were carrying on very intensive low-level photography. Now, no one would have guessed, probably, that that would have been such a harassment. Mr. Castro could not permit us to indefinitely continue widespread flights over his island at 200 feet every day. And yet he knew if he shot down one of our planes that then it would bring back a much more serious reprisal on him. So it's very difficult to always make judgments here about what the effect will be of our decisions on other countries. In this case, it seemed to me that we did pick the right one. In Cuba of 1961, we picked the wrong one.
I'd like to go back to the question of the consensus and your relationship to the consensus. You have said, and the Constitution says, that the decision can be made only by the president. Now, what was your relation to the consensus? Did you form no opinion until a consensus appeared, or were you part of forming the consensus? And had you disagreed with it, what then?
Well, I think that, you know, that old story about Abraham Lincoln in the cabinet. He says, all in favor say aye, and the whole cabinet voted aye, and then all opposed no, and Lincoln voted no, and he said the vote is no. So that naturally the Constitution places the responsibility on the president. There was some disagreement with the course we finally adopted, but the course we finally adopted had the advantage of permitting other steps if this one was unsuccessful. In other words, we were starting, in a sense, at a minimum place. Then, if that were unsuccessful, we could have gradually stepped it up until we had gone into a much more massive action, which might have become necessary if the first step had been unsuccessful. I would think that the majority finally came to accept that, though at the beginning there was a much sharper division. And after all, this was very valuable because the people who were involved had particular responsibilities of their own. Mr. McNamara, Secretary of Defense, who therefore had to advise me on the military capacity of the United States in that area, the Secretary of State, who had to advise on the attitude of the OAS, and NATO, so that, in my opinion, the majority came to accept the course we finally took. It made it much easier. The Cuba of 1961, the advice of those who were brought in on the executive branch was also unanimous, and the advice was wrong. So that, and I was responsible. So it finally comes down that no matter how many advisors you have, frequently they are divided, and the president must finally choose. The other point is something that President Eisenhower said to me in January 19th. He said, there are no easy matters will ever come to you as president. If they're easy, they will be settled at a lower level. So the matters that finally come to you as president are always the difficult matters, or matters which carry with them large implications. So this contributes to some of the burdens of the Office of the Presidency, which other presidents have commented on.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.